Welcome to the Zero Input Agriculture Podcast. Today, I have a guest who ticks all the boxes. They are a crop breeder, they are a low input farmer, and they are also doing so much on the side of social networking and helping to revive their local community culture. So I'm so excited to talk all about that. We have Mark W. Kidd here today, and I'll throw over to you. Tell us a bit about who you are and how you came to this obsession and fascination in your life.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here for the conversation today. I'm calling you from the Appalachian Mountains of Floyd County, Kentucky. For those who are somewhat familiar with the state's geography, I'm kind of in the part of Kentucky that also touches West Virginia and Tennessee and Virginia. And this is my family's farm. We've been farming here for most of the last 150 years. I'm kind of fortunate to be part of a tradition that goes back to the first Europeans that settled here after the Native Americans were expelled. And so I feel kind of a connection to the land, and that actually does help fuel my interest in low input agriculture. And I'm really and I in a lot of my conception, I have the business and social and kind of theoretical aspects of what I do. But then I also this is the place where my family has our cemeteries and where we come for reunions. And so it's a place that I'm really interested in understanding as a like as an ecosystem and a place where we've had such a long series of relationships or long stewardship, I think is probably a word I'd like to use. Professionally, I am a technical writer, an artist, and performer. I have used a lot of those skills, especially in the last 10 years or so, in supporting agriculture, working for and with the nonprofit organizations and government agencies, and also just individual people that are trying to build a new economy around food and agriculture in this area. And I'll stop in a moment, but I think the last thing to set up in my kind of context of the where I'm calling from is this area has gone through several major economic and human upheavals. One was the expulsion of the native people and the settlement period. The one that people talk about most often today is the decline of our coal industry and the changes in our like natural gas and timber industries. So 50 and 100 years ago, this region was being settled in waves of people come that came to work in the mines. And today, we're kind of at the end of decades of outmigration. And so we have an area here that has a lot fewer people than it did 50 or even 100 years ago. And so that's kind of hopefully get to give some idea of where we are.
Now, that is such a interesting scenario to study because all around the world, well, almost everywhere around the world, we're facing a demographic collapse. So even without people migrating from one place to another, just the number of people that will be in the next generation is probably going to decrease. So how cultures and societies deal with those pressures is, I mean, your part of the world is basically a little test case. We can use you as a kind of example to get some ideas about what we might be in for, what our future generations will be facing.
I think that's probably well said. And one of the differences in working in food and agriculture in the eastern parts of Kentucky in the mountainous areas is that at this point in our history, there are in our counties, which is the local administrative division. So a county in this remote rural area might have 10 to 20,000 people in it, and two or three larger cities of maybe 5,000 people. So we've kind of, I've lost my train of thought a little bit, but we're at a point here where we may in a county only have 10 or 20 farms that are operating commercially. And many of those are going to be relatively small. And many of those will actually have been established within the last 10 years, where the industrial era of Eastern Kentucky didn't mean that people stopped growing food, but it really meant that there were so many people moving in, and there was so much industrial activity that the food systems we have were all kind of from that period, were all designed to haul in food. And so we're hauling out coal and timber and later natural gas, and food is being brought in. So we're in a very rural area, but when that kind of phase of our economy started to end, there wasn't an infrastructure left around like wholesaling local foods, and there have been issues having slaughterhouses for meat. And so I wish that it were a little easier for farms to get going and to be successful here. But when we look at a lot of what's going on, not there are some commercial farms that have been around for a long time, but a lot of what we see is kind of the result of relatively new thinking or energy or visionary work in some cases. A lot of people kind of paddling against the current because they really believe in growing food. And so professionally, beyond what I grow myself here, I've had the chance to help support some of those people that I consider maybe not, I think there's a danger in maybe making it sound too heroic because it sounds impossible, but those people who are everyday inspirations, I guess, trying to set up a system here so people aren't completely isolated when they're trying these things out.
To give you a bit of a context from my end, Australia as a colony for the first 100 years was a net food importer. So we used to get shipments of like moldy flour and grain to keep us from starving from London or wherever. And we'd send them our gold and our amazing timber that, it was like hundreds of years old. And then we'd graze everything down with sheep and send the wool back. And I'm so jealous that you're coming from a perspective where you have a culture of 150 years of farming in your family, versus Australia that went from hunter-gatherer to industrial farming with almost nothing in between. So when our currently booming coal-based economy goes through a similar cycle to what happened in Appalachia, I think we could be in for a really hard landing. So we need to look to examples of places like where you are and get a glimpse about what's in the future and how we can respond to that in a productive and positive way. So yeah, I'm just so chuffed to talk to you today.
When I think it's really, thank you for bringing in Australia's colonial history. There are some economic theorists who have used the concept of an internal colony for Appalachia to model the way the coal and timber booms worked. And I know there is some criticism of that, but I think there's a lot of truth to it. The one thing I want to mention, because it maybe part of the connection between our two parts of the world. My ancestors, generally speaking, were like the other first and second waves of settlers here, in that, generally speaking, we weren't successful farmers from Europe or Eastern Virginia, depending on which group my ancestors. We were really like economic migrants that, as a group, had more like a labor background than a farming. And so there are some really important traditions that have been passed down from before the Europeans got here. But between the fact that so many of the settlers were just from a manual labor or economic migrant background, and the fact that we had expelled most of the native people, not all of them either, but it's led to a kind of narrowing. And then, 30 or 40 years after that period, we start to industrialize. So this is an area with some really important agricultural traditions around staple foods, corn and beans, and less squash right in here in Eastern Kentucky. But on the other hand, I think even some of the really traditional knowledge about landrace breeding that I've acquired mostly through the work of people like going to see J Julia and Anna and Joseph Lofthouse. Like, I wouldn't, I mean, I think the opportunity for people in my generation is to be able to take what our local legacy, which is important, but kind of narrow or siloed, I think, maybe,
Yeah,
and start
fragmented.
to, yeah, I I'd like to, I really, one of the things I I appreciate about Joseph Lofthouse as a writer on these topics is that he talks about his family's roots as European peasant farmers. I think in my family, because of our background and the experiences settling the mountains here, we've lost continuity with whatever gardening or farming may have existed there too. So I feel like one of the great loops of the some of these open pollinated diverse methods of growing vegetables is a chance to kind of plug in what part I have for my background into something that's a little bigger and a little bit more cosmic. And if you can't tell, I do like to think about the times long ago and ancient history and all of that. That's part of what I enjoy about farming is just imagining all of the people who've done it before. I feel like I spend a ton of time doing that.
Well, in another 1,000 years, we'll be those people to somebody in the future, and they might still be growing something descended from a crop that we worked on.
So true. Yeah. Well, that's so exciting. I
So
like to, I think that's important to be. I think it's not everyone needs to do this kind of gardening and farming, but that's one way to be part of humanity. There's a lot of other ways too, you know?
Now I want to talk about some of the crops that you're working on, and you have one in particular that seems to be the love of your life. So do you want to start telling us about, I didn't even know how it's pronounced, actually. It's not a word that we use very often in Australia.
Oh, well, and here locally we pronounce it Kushaw. There are some folks not even that far away from us here that would pronounce it Kershaw, and they'd add an R to the word. So I just like the variety has this traditional genetic diversity. It's reflected in the names. I think that's probably one of those signs that you've got something special.
So
And
tell
so
us about
the
this
Kushaw,
species. Yeah, tell us about this
yeah.
species.
And like many things botanical, Kushaw isn't a precise scientific term, but in my area, when we use that word, we're talking about a squash that is of the species Cucurbita argyrosperma. And I think at this point in history, since it was often called Cucurbita mixta until a few years ago, it's good to maybe mention both of those names. But it is one of the five domesticated squash. I feel like I already am hedging my bets. I'm like, is it really five? Because some people write three and I'm like, they're not right. And then there's some people are writing four. I'm like, no, it's more than that. There's the five domesticated squash species that I grow. There we go.
And is it the least common of the five?
I have recently tried out comparing it to Cucurbita ficifolia, the Chile coyote or shark fin melon, because it seems similar in that there is a historic range where it's widely available at even on the side of the road here, and everyone knows what it is at least by name. But then if you travel maybe 100 miles north or maybe west of here, people may not even know what the word is, or they might have some vague association. So I think, and from my reading, my understanding is that we are one of the northernmost areas that historically grew this species of squash, and its range goes from Kentucky and Maryland and Indiana down to what's now like New Mexico and down into Mexico. And so in all these areas, you might very commonly find it.
Is there a reason why it is preferred, or it's present in that part of the world and it hasn't spread more widely? Do you, because it's kind of competing for a function in a farm that, winter squash and other kinds of more familiar squashes can do the same thing to some degrees. So is there a reason why it's remained so prominent in your part of the world?
I can speculate that it's because it grows really well here. I think it m may be as simple as that. The archaeologists in the English-speaking world have theories about that are related to this, and so I can mention that the Argyrosperma species or the Kushaws are, it's kind of uncommon to find named varieties. There are some. So that's just one. It's people around here will describe them with an attribute, like, that one's sweet or it's long storing. We mostly just call them Kushaws. There are three, uses, which are common in other squash too, but there are Kushaws that are really renowned for their seeds. There are some that are renowned for summer squash use, and there are some that are really known as winter squash that store longer and have sweeter flesh. And the archaeology I've read has no strong theories on exactly why, but it seems that in the ancient times of thousands of years ago, most of the people that were eating this species were not using it for a winter squash. Only in what's now northern Mexico into the southern United States were people breeding this squash for that those characteristics. And so all of these things together, it's I think has in some ways kind of hindered modern Kushaw growers because there aren't very many named varieties that, and so people there's nothing in a perverse way. Marketing does kind of help sometimes preserve genetic diversity because people there's no sign saying this is the amazing, sweet Kushaw. That's what my project will be doing. But kind of there, so people kind of this. I've gotten a bit off track here. So as I've gotten on the scene and become interested in these Kushaws, I've started to learn these things and began to draw some conclusions. I think I'll pause there.
I wonder if it, because I know that during the 1800s, that was the era of seed catalogs, where you'd get this thing turn up in the mail and then you'd like order the seeds, but you needed a description that made a particular packet of seed stand out from all of the others. It was almost like Instagram, where like, a purple tomato, everyone like, ooh, purple tomato. It could taste like nothing, but because it translates well in that new medium. And yeah, I wonder if maybe the Kushaw missed out, like their diversity and their flexibility counted against them because they hadn't already been like pigeonholed into recognizable brands.
I think that's quite. I've tried to spend some appropriate amount of time leafing through old seed catalogs to see what varieties were listed, and you would there are a few from the early era of seed catalogs, like the Jonathan Pumpkin, which is a white Kushaw, and the Japanese Pie Pumpkin, which is named that because the seeds have this kind of unusual etched appearance.
Oh, yes.
It's they're not that they're not common. I wonder. And I do believe you've probably encountered this like I have that the early period of seed catalogs and distribution really messed some things up. Whatever got prioritized for that first generation of commercial seeds disproportionately affected what's come since. And what I might share is that my experience buying Kushaws and trading and asking about them from other growers in an area here of that's about 60 or 80 miles, kind of linear, that is my kind of my territory that I travel. I've been talking to produce stand vendors who, and it's just there's one in particular who's been a real asset and taught me a lot, and she's a both a produce stand vendor and a seed vendor. And so, and she has several crops, including the other kinds of pumpkins and winter squash, where she actually kind of maintains her own seeds. And if you go to her, you can buy them, you can grow them, and then bring them back and sell them to her wholesale, which is this is a traditional business model that it's kind of uncommon now. But it's interesting. Kushaw's is the one winter squash that I think she always sells that she doesn't have her own seed varieties of. It happens to be just in this moment in time, maybe because there isn't a marketing demand for specific characteristics, but it's the winter squash that farmers can bring in and it can look about any way, and they're bringing it from save seeds or whatever their source. And there aren't like commercial standards. I guess that's a long way of saying she doesn't have any kind of commercial standards for that. And she knows which ones are winter and summer types. I've been learning that from her. But yeah, why the difference?
Do you think it helped the Kushaw preserve, ironically preserve more of that breadth of genetic diversity that it wasn't turned into the like the one perfect variety that everyone knew the name of.
I think that's possible, but and then for people that are interested in maintaining diversity, like myself and maybe some of your listeners, there is a generational moment going on right now where a lot of the people who I've been getting their fruit or seeds from or getting mentored by are in their 70s, and the seed that is most important to the project came from one of these frozen collections inherited by the descendant of a gardener. And so I think there is a what kind of a moment going on right now where I can't really imagine that there are new growers yet that are going to take on growing these kushaws. And that has sort of mo motivated me to act. I think that's part of it is both finding a real treasure of good variety that grows well, and also the kind of realization that like the people that I'm talking to are elderly, or they're just growing out their grandparents' seed, and then there's like not maybe going to be an infinite amount of time. I will try to make a parallel with another area of plant diversity, which is I'm also very interested in perennials and wild annuals too. And I live in a temperate rainforest. It is very, like a couple hundred years ago, it was extremely genetically diverse. And even today, ironically, I think in some cases, you might think after all this mining, we're in a situation where there was a bunch of land that was kind of in regular industrial use and was all disturbed, that's been abandoned over a period of just decades or years. And right now, and there are all kinds of like feral, like garden escapee plants, and there are still apple trees in abandoned areas, and there's also a lot of like wild edibles and wild crop relatives that just naturally grow here. Like when I travel even to other parts of the state of Kentucky that are more agriculturally productive, it's humbling to think that here in this kind of post-industrial area, we have all of these plants that are really useful and even desirable, and they just are growing in abandoned places. But I have come to understand succession a little bit, and I'm seeing what the humans are doing here, and I am sort of realizing that a lot of these homestead sites that were abandoned in the, 20 or 30 years ago, there's not that's th their feral vegetables will be gone eventually. Like they don't, that's not something where I get to come back year after year. So I've been kind of th thinking about these themes of what, like in the, I used to work for somebody that would talk about the present historical moment to help you kind of think with a bigger frame of mind. And like, what is the present historical moment here?
Now, with the kushaws, how did you source your material and what kind of selection strategy? Because you sound like you're in a rare situation where you probably have to do some selection when you're sourcing material. Like you couldn't grow everything that you could get your hands on.
That's really true. I am fortunate to be able to make one direct contact in person with other growers. And I see these squash for sale also. And so if something catches my eye, I have bought it. That's a funny way to start this story. Let me put it, I've been growing them myself for 3 years, and it's only been this year and since our season completed this year that I've become interested in a community project. But from friends that garden, and I actually don't think I started with any purchased kushaw seed. I did start all of my, now that I'm thinking of it, 2 years ago, three now, I started with all local seed from seed swaps, but I didn't know very much about the different kinds of kushaws, and I spent 2 years growing in a fun, open pollinated way, like two or three varieties that were mainly good for summer squash or seeds. And I was still very interested in growing them. It was partly because they grow as well as any other kind of squash or almost any other big vegetable here. So I knew even a bland Kushaw was interesting to me. But I was driving my car on a rural road not far from the farm a year and a half ago, and I saw from my car a guy like setting some Kushaws on the top of a flatbed truck, probably looking like he's going to try to sell them on the side of the road. And I could see it was so sad. It's so sad now because I kind of knew even when I saw them from my car that they were better than anything I'd grown in some way. And I then of like the more I spent time with those Kushaws that had been grown from seed in a freezer, inherited freezer, that they were like, you could just, I don't know, visually, it's hard to describe, but even looking at a lot of these and growing them, you're like, wow, those are a little different and I must find out. And it turned out that they store longer than any that I'd grown, and they're much oranger, sweeter flesh, and they had a different looking seed than the kinds I'd grew. And I did give away a lot of my saved Kushaw seeds from the last 2 years. I saved a bit, but I kind of, it's not the only time I've ever done this, but I realized that there was another world of genetics, and I really was kind of at a dead end for what I wanted to do. And from then on, though, I've spent this year growing that squash myself and keeping in contact with the folks I originally got it from, and I shared it with some of my friends who've been growing it. And so you'd asked for the story of this, but as I grew the Kushaw myself this year, what we'll call the prototype Commonwealth Kushaw, it did better than almost anything else. I planted a few of some other allegedly good Kushaw seeds at the end of the bed, and they may have crossed. Which would be fine, but the Commonwealth Kushaw Mark One is just really good. And the lessons for me were several, that this, the plant could produce this in theory, the species, that it could last all winter and into the next summer at room temperature. And it kind of gave me a more of a mandate this year as I was making my rounds to ask, like, has anyone else seen some like this? And I think I'm still trying to tell you about how I did my selections, but once I start putting the word around, and I got introduced to this market owner who I've mentioned earlier, who's also a seed vendor. One of my mutual friends said, "Mark, you've got to meet this person. They're a Kushaw expert." And she's had me holding Kushaws and trying to feel the patterns of warts. And so at least our local genetics, I've learned some of the telltale signs of what will make a good winter one. But it's still, I'm looking at them now. I don't know. I probably have 30 Kushaws from five or six other farms here with me, and I'm cutting them open and eating them with friends. But we found a few that I thought were possibly like going to be awesome, and they were summer types, or they just, and that's kind of the fun of it. But I think in a world where many of the people who are other than me who are buying these Kushaws are doing them for decorations. Like, again, there's like, I'm at a point where some of the people that are growing Kushaws, they don't eat them either, and that's totally fine. But it's kind of like a moment to, before everything gets so mixed up and it's all just seedy, bland ones, can we find and pull out some of these winter types, especially?
You're in a really interesting position because so many other people doing the landrace crop, they're starting from nothing. There's no local tradition. They have to filter through as much genetic diversity of a crop that they can get and then start mixing it together to like build up to something that works for them. But you've got something that sounds like it's almost perfect, already locally adapted, right on your doorstep that is in danger of being lost. But you have some openness to genetic diversity. Like you're balancing that diversity against the quality that's already there, right?
Yes, and I have, having found and grown, excuse me, I'll start over. Having found this Kushaw, the Commonwealth, and sharing it with some of my friends who grew up at the same time as me, I think it was their this is such an important topic. I'm overthinking it, but like we're going to see, as you may know, sometimes we talk about the different imperatives about saving an important like legacy variety that might be very inbred, or it may have, may have some deficiencies, but it's like lasted this long and it's clearly got something to offer, and we respect the people who developed it. So there's a balance between saving those varieties where we may know who we got it from and who they got it from, versus what may be a more of a traditional breeding approach that led to that Kershaw, that has to do with letting it be open pollinated with some consideration. But I, Shane, one of the ideas that I think of yours that I identified with when we were speaking before this podcast is the idea of, in a seed project, having a small group of designated gardeners who are kind of part of the team and may have a responsibility to grow the seeds a certain way, like, for example, not to let them be pollinated with other types. And as I have been trying to carefully respect the Kershaw legacy that we've inherited, I am also really aware of the power of letting things cross-pollinate. And the Commonwealth Kershaw Mark I, we may have to not use Mark I since that's my first name, but this, it has a really short neck most of the time. And it's got the best tasting Kershaw flesh that I've ever eaten, but it's kind of sometimes can be a little limited. And I've got a room, almost everything else has a that I've gathered from around here has a much longer neck. So wouldn't it be nice if the Commonwealth Kershaw had a little bit more? And as we continue to check in, you can see how this works out. I have in my plans to ask, and I guess I've started asking a couple of people to just grow kind of the pure seed that I got. And I'm going to be sharing, I hope, the spirit of this landrace open pollination with other gardeners and some of the people that I don't know as well from the community who grow the Kershaws, because I would like, partly because I know that having diverse seeds increases the odds that something will grow well. I want people to have fun with this. And but I think my concept is really to share a diverse packet of seed with most of the people. But I in this case, I've talked to the grower who originally shared these seeds with me, because his ancestor is how we have them at all, and they're not concerned about what's going on here. They're not going to be growers actively, but in this case, because the way I've gone about it, I've been able to get permission to share these, I guess, and pretty much even the ones I've paid for my collection of local Kershaw. So but I'm really interested in, I want to convey in the communications material both the like awesomeness of keeping a variety true and pure, and the awesomeness of like letting the white Kershaws and the yellow ones cross and seeing what happens. So I don't know. We'll have to figure that out.
Couple of questions. Does your climate allow two staggered crops 1 year? So, like, you could potentially put the really diverse ones early or late, and then you could put the pure ones at a different time. So the amount of crossing between them is manageable. And you could potentially check for things like, I don't know, early maturity or frost tolerance at the end of the season in the really diverse population if you had like that those two strands running at the same time.
That's a great idea. I hadn't thought of that. It's the Kershaw is one of the longer. It takes that. I think it's possible. I think you could do that in two rounds. And I say that because this year we had a rough year, and I replanted all of the squash like a couple of times. So if you have a more typical rainfall, I think, yeah, we probably could. The Kershaws are, the seed packet number would be like 110 to 120 days to maturity. And we're in a temperate climate, but it's so it can kind of depend year to year. But I think I think one of the things I will just suggest to people with my recent experience in mind is it would, whether you're doing it to stagger the pollination or not, 2 or 3 staggered plantings of Kershaws is a good idea as a, just a best practice. So,
Yeah.
yeah, thank you. That's an excellent suggestion.
Just a thought. I mean, you're in a very different climate to me, so I don't know what your challenges are. The other thing you could potentially do would be to alternate. Like 1 year you grow the pure kind and you try and perfect it, and then the next season you just have an anything goes, like all the diversity that you can get to create like a completely wild Grex. But I mean, it depends on how big your population is too, like how much genetic diversity you can actually cram into one population in any season.
I think, and that this year would have been the crazy diverse year, really. So maybe next year I'll focus on a like a little less variety. I will, between you and me and anyone else who hears this, one concern that I have in the back of my head, and it's irrational, I know, but I grew my Kershaws that I'll be sharing seeds from in a garden that with dozens and dozens of other squash plants, but that it partly because we had I'd replanted and just my what I chose to plant later, and also just what I'm growing. I have a lot of interspecies hybrids, and I also am growing wild pepo squash, which is known to cross with Kershaws. And I have stayed up a couple of times at night thinking, oh, it'll be really obvious if the egg gourd pepos crossed with Kershaws when people are growing them, they'll know something's amiss. But I do think this year my garden will be the one where the potential wildness will come from.
Do you do any hand pollination, like any controlled crosses? Because cucurbits are like the best of all possible crops for doing this. They're big, chunky flowers. The timing's pretty obvious, and you get so many seeds from one cross.
I have started my manual squash pollination this year with those wild pepo squash because they have the bitter toxin for one reason. And I have to say, I think if anyone listening has been wondering if they should try manual pollination, it's definitely worth trying. This year I had projects going both where I did like mass, like everyday emasculation, removing all the male flowers on certain squash
Which you
and
can eat,
letting
by
the
the
bees
way.
pollinate.
You can eat
What's
them. You
that?
can like make an omelet with them when you're done.
I really need to do that. I know that's possible. But I'm the kind of person that will like, I'm like, okay, I know this is an edible flower. So I'm out here in the garden. I'll eat one petal just to sort of demonstrate that I know it's not a problem. But that's so true, especially if you're doing mass removals like that every day. And I have a project around pepo squash where I've found it's great to be able to do both. I, with some guidance over the internet from another gardener, I learned how to dry the male flowers so that I could keep the pollen viable for a much longer period of time. And it was great. I mean, I, like anything, my first idea of what bags to use and how to handle them was totally wrong. And I got some different supplies, and but I've just begun doing that kind of manual pollination. But I'm quite excited about it. And one of the fun reasons about working some with wild squash is, and that egg gourd, see, everyone seems to think it's a pretty primitive genetically, like wild type, is that it should be even easier to do wide crosses and weird things with them. I'm really looking forward to trying some of those crosses out. I spend a lot of time reading research papers about interspecific squash crosses. Every time I feel like I've read all of the ones from the last 20 years that I can find with Google Scholar searching, like, interspecific cucurbita, I find another 5 or 6. And one of the many things I've learned is that people have only really tried, in a documented academic environment, they've only tried a very limited number of crosses. And I think these squash are real weird, and I've come under the influence of people that believe that probably you can cross a lot more of them if you're doing it manually than you would
I get the
expect.
impression that whether two species are cross fertile depends more on the exact strains of those species that you're using and not so much on the label of the species name.
Yes, and I think it's which I think that's sort of exciting, and there are folks who, and I there's a person who publishes on the Going to Seed site under the name Professor Porcupine publicly, so if it's okay to share that pseudonym, and he has really influenced me in a positive way with this idea of gathering and drying a whole bunch of male flowers from a bunch of different varieties and species of squash and putting it all in one of these paper bags and just pollinating a bunch of your good female flowers with this mix of stuff that shouldn't even on paper work. And I actually I've start I've seen the I've seen some evidence that that does work, and I'm really excited about doing that
Is
in the
there any
future.
potential for a semi-wild form of squash in your region that still produces a useful crop? Like, could the bitterness actually be a positive in terms of like pest resistance and particularly deer, I think, could be an issue in your part of the world?
We do deer are definitely a big issue. This year, the deer we had drought, and the deer were consuming squash for the liquids. It was brutal in the Kershaw field, as actually. But I kind of was trending towards this topic of semi-wild squash by talking about my bitter egg gourds. I feel one of the exciting aspects of the ecology here is that Eastern Kentucky is home to one of the wild squash ancestor species, the Cucurbita pepo, what now they're calling the subspecies ovifera. So it's the same subspecies as the crookneck summer squash and the patty pan. It's the pepos with the very thin stems and relatively small fruits. So the only wild type of squash that's been gathered anywhere around here has been of the nest egg gourd types. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but they look just like a chicken egg. And the wild types are bitter, and they probably are the progenitor. Having bred with them for 2 years now, I can see the shapes that come out of them look a lot like the, summer squash shapes that I'm familiar with. So I find it very believable that this is the ancestor of those nice edible ones. And I am, there are, I'm going to posit that there are genes that can allow two different levels of bitterness in the toxic squash, but I wouldn't think that either one of them is going to become edible except the seeds by boiling. One is horrifically bitter, and the other is, still toxically bitter. I can tell my mouth knows, but I've been working to back cross just the non-bitter genes needed to have what I hope over the next couple of years will be an egg gourd that is not bitter, but still has all of the other wild characteristics, which, and I think one of those key ones being that it hollows out and forms a floating gourd. And I've made substantial progress on this. I know for a fact that there are wild populations out there that have some non-bitter genes floating around in them for whatever reason. And another completely valid approach for me would have been trying to receive as many wild squash fruits as possible and just growing out as many as I can and tasting all of them. But I have chosen to do crosses and experiment with the breeding of it. But I totally think that it's possible to have a wild living small pepo winter squash, or just a squash that in my vision of the egg gourd is that I will see these egg gourds growing out along my creek and other places people have planted them. And if you're walking around at the right time, you can grab one, and it's the size of a big chicken egg, and you can take it home and just slice it up and cook it. It might be not the sweetest summer squash you've ever had, but yeah, that you'll be able to walk out. And the non-bitter close relatives of the egg gourds, like you can pick them immature and eat them raw off of the vine. So I do think that actually will be possible. And then the ones you leave there will harden over the winter, and maybe if there's a flood, they'll float downstream a little bit. But we're that's the kind of I am interested sometimes in something that's a little less yield or flavor at the if it can self-seed or grow without input. One of the sites that has been growing the Kershaws with me this last year and will continue is a strip mine. And so, and it seems that this farm, this a demonstration farm that some of my friends are running up there, we're going to grow our relationship even closer. And I've been taking some of my most promising seeds and sometimes live plants to this area that has only a few inches of fill, and seeing what we can get to grow, things like hops and apple trees and Kershaw squash and some other feral pepos. And I do think that squash, because we've done this, has the potential to grow like nutritious food on like waste areas. And what I would like to see in places like where these folks have several thousand acres of former coal mines is that it doesn't even have to be the whole thing, but we really could be seeding those areas with edibles and medicinals in proportion to the, reforestation trees and grasses and stuff to stabilize the soil. So
We and I'm guessing that there's probably other crops that you're working on as well, but I want to make sure we leave plenty of time to talk about the social networking work that you've been doing, which is so unusual. But the final question I always ask in this section on crop breeding, if you could wave a magic wand and create any crop that you can imagine, then what would you wish for?
oh, what a good prompt. And I think this is it's I feel like some pressure because I think about this regularly, this kind of thing. I'm like, I want to give a really good answer to this one. But I would really like to have a perennial bean, actually. And the reason there are some perennial species of beans that are native here. I can walk outside right now and grab you some bean leaves, even at this cold time of year, but they don't produce pods, not even every year. And when they do, they're tiny. But I kind of, it's not that I hate growing beans, but I don't really like it either. And they're a really important part of my cuisine and the traditional cuisine here. And I'm surrounded right now by beans that people have given me. It's because I want to keep trying to find a good one. But yeah, I would just like a bean that I didn't feel like I had to worry about,
Oh, and again, like the potential for something to be semi-wild, if you get that balance right between vigor and the quality of the output, then suddenly this vast, degraded landscape becomes a garden.
Well, and in the I think in the I appreciate gardening and farming because it does kind of require the people to work in these areas of technical expertise and to really be aware of the systems, whether you're working with a more traditional framework for gardening and planting by the signs, the astrological signs, or you're reading a bunch of research. And so I do like to think about this bean project because I know that in our native perennial beans have been it seems genetically they're kind of closely related both to kudzu and to soybeans. And so you just think, wow, of all the wide crosses out there that are much farther apart species than these, there must be something that, when we have kudzu kind of covering big areas of the land here. So there's like wild beans growing everywhere. And you start to learn that they've done genetic sequencing. And yeah, maybe it's possible, especially to connect up with some other people that are interested in that. And I'm, yeah, so
Now,
exciting.
we can move on to the section where I'm interested in any ways that you've managed to reduce the inputs in your production. So, particularly working with a locally adapted crop, has that given you advantages in pulling back on the amount of support that it needs?
I think so. I do think it has proven useful to go out in search of local genetics and also wild genetics. My work now this year, I'm thinking to make sure I say this is something that's accurate. Yeah, we had a very serious flood in 2022 here, and it destroyed like a lot of the vegetable gardens that I had out, and it also kind of demonstrated areas that needed like drainage work, and just suggested for safety and other reasons that I might go ahead and move all of the cultivated area to be right around the house. This is a good permaculture principle according to Paul Wheaton, which is, your zone zero or zone one of your permaculture garden is the closest to your house. And you put the things you want to deal with the most right there. And for me, that was a bunch of wild and feral Pepo squash crosses that I had to visit almost every day. But what it very little of the area around the house has ever been planted. This is about 3/4 of an acre of land, and it's like flower gardens and bushes. So I have been, and this house is built on fill from a coal mine. Now that was 30 years ago. So we've had a little more time to build up some organic material than my friends at the former strip mine. But I guess what I'm trying to get at is since the flood here, I have focused my growing in an area that has pretty much unimproved soil that's somewhat acidic from the composition and the history of mining. And it's pretty low in organic matter. And I have, so in all of the gardening around this house here, I have not really added any organic matter at all, and let alone fertilizer or pesticide or herbicide. I've been really, one thing that ironically is abundant in my neighborhood, considering it's a very remote area, is cardboard. There's a grocery store nearby that allows me to selectively remove cardboard as much as I want. And so I've been using that to extinguish grass. And it's been a real, one of the things that I do that is kind of a social aspect of my gardening is that in the last year, especially, I've worked with five other gardens and pretty much for my friends, where they have grown out some of my seed. So everything from a former coal mine to like urban vegetable garden with soil that's been amended over the years. And it has been fascinating to see the same seeds performing very differently, from nothing happening to I'll get very small fruits here compared to the big fruits in the urban garden. So we'll have a real spectrum. But I think as I've been doing mass trials, it is very clear, especially if you're talking about maybe a species like Cucurbita moschata, the butternut squash species. That one's kind of hard to get growing here. And I have even the going to seed diverse seed packets that we have access to in the United States, they just are not growing moschata squash successfully. And it took me several years to find anyone that was growing it in my area, but their seeds are producing fruit. It's not, I'll need another year or two probably to have good fruit. But I think just as I next year, depending on what all happens, I will be expanding back into some gardens here at the farm that are have historically had investment in them. So I'm looking forward to having some more yield. But I hope I'm not introducing too many themes, but I had a chance to try something like 15 tomato varieties because I was planting them in like at least three different gardens. And my garden here on the 30-year-old coal mining fill, I can grow lots of cherry tomatoes and I can grow Roma tomatoes. The beefsteak tomatoes do not live. And I think being part of a group that's growing the same beefsteak tomatoes that are all that like chosen thoughtfully, then they're growing perfectly fine in an area down the road. That helps me understand that actually is so critical when things are going wrong and there's nothing to compare it to. It's really difficult. So I found that it's taken time But like, and it's been fun social time generally, but it like spending the effort to go visit sometimes and share seeds with some friends has really paid off for me. Looking at things in terms of input.
It's interesting too, because a lot of the way modern gardeners are kind of classically trained is that if you can't trick something into growing, regardless of whether it wants to or not, it's kind of your fault that you didn't add this and add that and do this and do that. And sometimes the soil and the microclimate that you happen to have in front of you, no matter what you do, no matter how many things you add to it, it's never going to suit a particular kind of crop or a particular strain of that crop. And that's what I love about the land racing kind of movement. It's embracing that failure and just moving on from it, trying something else.
Yeah, I am, and it's been fun to, I have enjoyed sharing that idea as part of sharing these seeds out too, and I think that's one of the things that I want. I'm an artist and a self-employed person and entrepreneur, and so sometimes I kind of know how I work, and I've designed some of my vegetable breeding projects and then my volunteer time with going to seed so that I have opportunities to try to share some of these ideas over and over again. This is how I work, and this is one reason I knew I needed to commit to a bigger community project, is just because I've found myself over the last year really, really not trying to convince people. I hope. I don't think I've really been trying to like bend their ear per se, but just I think there is something kind of powerful about, and the fun of it too, like the what I'm hoping I've shared with some of my friends this year is the fun of saving seeds, and also like something that I'm glad going to seed reinforces it, but some of the traditional seed keepers here, it's like tasting everything that you save, and it makes it kind of a game for me with my personality, is I'm like I really want to see if that which if any of these tomatoes will actually taste good or not be a spitter. And like the kind of loop back to the local environment is just like so fascinating to me. And I think it's one of the ways I try to share these ideas is I will, like I did earlier in this conversation, I'll be like, imagine this area 100 years ago or 200 years ago. And when you wanted to start a new garden, what did you do then? Like, who did you ask for help? Where did you get your seeds? What kind of information would you have? And I think for me, a lot of like what I've been concluding doing that thought experiment over and over again and trying to get other people to do it is that there is a lot of the things that are different about farming now and out here in Eastern Kentucky have made it less fun and less social. And also at the same time, there's less good information about what works. But I really feel in my mental image of the past, it was a time when you could walk down the country road here, and if you walked for an hour, you meet several other gardeners, and they might have similar or different ideas, and they might share some seeds with you, and like you're. Like the stakes, I feel like the modern way of teaching gardening, it has to be like it is probably, but it is almost like you get taught a philosophy of seed keeping or using hybrids or amending, and it's not even that it's not the best solution, but I think it misses the historic truth, which is that you would be like having all kinds of exposure to different people trying different things, and the fun and freedom of that is what I'm hoping people can pick up from this like land race type breeding stuff. I noticed on your blog you were writing recently at the time of recording about your tomato project,
Oh, yes.
and I one reason I noticed it is it seems like you prioritize the drying types of tomatoes. You've got some, and co coincidentally, that is also there's a volunteer tomato that I grow, and I think it actually kind of naturally dehybridized from a something commercial, but it sh showed up in my lawn in my place in town y years ago, And then it showed up like 2 more years. And it's taken me a while to classify it because I just hadn't encountered one like that before. But it is one of these Mediterranean drying types, and it's kind of it was famous in our neighborhood because it grew in this really terrible spot year after year. And at 1 year, it even skipped a year. And we thought, oh, well, they're finally dead. And then it came back. It skipped one. And so I started saving seeds at some point there. But I think that's an example of something like really fun. And that one was growing like right next to a paved road, like where it really shouldn't. And it was great because it was so prolific for years. People would tell people to stop by there and just take however much they wanted. And so I mean, that's just my experience with that kind of tomato. But it I that's what I that's that would that's the perfect way for something like this to go, if you ask me.
Now, moving on to talk about social networks, do you want to give us a broad idea of all the things you've been involved in your community? Because you sent me some links and I was really, what's the word? Inspired, I think. Because my little community, there's things here, but it feels like there could be so much more. So yeah, tell me more. Tell me more.
Thank you. I think at this point in my life, I have realized that I really value networks of people. And in fact, I've placed such a priority on working with and kind of through networks of people. I think it might be how I have to work. I'm not sure I know any other ways. And living in a really remote rural area might contribute to this tendency a bit. And so what I have been part of, I guess we've talked a little bit about how Appalachia and like my part in Eastern Kentucky has really had some upheavals and demographic changes. And so it may not be a surprise that our economy is not that strong here. If you're like me and you work in the arts or nonprofit administration, generally you're commuting 30 minutes, an hour, or an hour and a half. People, it's hard to, you're lucky if you're able to live right next to where you work around here. And in reality, for me and since other artists and farmers and small business owners, many of us find that we also have to travel outside of Eastern Kentucky to make our living. And so I think being an Appalachian is like an identity of a group of people that have migrated all over the United States and the world at this point. And I have been part of groups of people that are kind of our mission is to say, look, we know that we're going against the current to try to be professional artists or to start farms. We are going to, as part of that effort, establish organizations to pool our resources. There's a really strong history of community-based work in Eastern Kentucky on all kinds of topics, where we have businesses that are kind of very small, sometimes off the radar of government programs to support them, or farms that are only selling a few thousand dollars worth of produce per year and aren't definitely not qualifying for crop insurance. And what we do here, culturally, I think, is we form nonprofit organizations. Some places, I think they form co-ops. That's not part of our tradition here, but we form nonprofit organizations and seek grants and sometimes like commercial contracts that can be distributed to the small farms or small artists. And I don't know, I'm somehow focusing really in on financing. There are other aspects, but I one of the things I do specialize in working for networks is raising money. And so I'm very passionate about, and I benefit from this myself too, but there are many opportunities that if you may live in a rural, remote area and you may not have what you need for pay or health insurance, but if you could just get $5,000 for your project, or you could just get the opportunity to travel and learn something, then you could go on about your business and try to produce or take care of your family. And so there's quite a movement around here for people to try to band together and go after those resources. And it's a kind of, it can be when I travel, and I have traveled a lot professionally, it can be a little different when I go to, it could be difficult when I'm in other parts of the United States to characterize why it's important or different that people are organizing themselves like that here. But it's whether it's because it's remote and rural, or because in like our economies for many of these sectors are really so fractured from our history, or for other reasons, cultural reasons, it is kind of these associations and community nonprofits are really like essential. Let me try to illustrate. Like, we have a program that I've been a part of in different ways here called Grow Appalachia. And if you have never gardened, or if you have, you can apply in many areas of this region to a program that will try to match you with a kind of tailored one-on-one resources you need. A lot of times this might be sending someone with a tractor to till, actually. There's not many people offering that service anymore. But we have these programs that have been developed, and I've been a part, that will kind of go from seed all the way through like value-added production. And so a lot of our farms here are small, and I've mentioned this before, it's not unusual for a farm that's successful at a farmer's market here to only be doing $4,000 or $5,000 or $6,000 annually in sales. But kind of the amazing thing about that is that it's kind of been like all the farms that are operating at that size now, just a little bigger than mine, commercial, at least in terms of budget, have been kind of.
Well, one thought I can possibly throw at you is for these kind of community crop breeding, seed sharing organizations, is the biggest challenge continuity of like maintaining a kind of a cultural practice across many years, that they tend to kind of start and stop when key inspired personnel who are kind of driving the project fall in and out of being able to do that role?
I think that is really well said. And I think there's nothing, what I try to consider as I'm sometimes designing programs or participating in them is like, and maybe it's not inherently, it doesn't have to inherently be a problem that initiatives kind of stop and start if we're designing them for that from the beginning. But I
They have
think
like
if
a
I,
they have an end of life cycle kind of dry down into a durable form that can, it's like a seed that it's going to wait until it's the right time to sprout again.
Yeah, when I'm feeling cynical, maybe I'm hanging out with some other people that are handle like grant funds professionally, and we're having ennui about our future. Like it, I think like the that was such a ridiculous. I'm getting a little tired. I need to keep it focused here. One of the things that can be frustrating in my professional life is that I feel actually that I've been a part of many projects that have been conceived as a like a pilot project. And I'm in an industry of nonprofit agriculture and arts that kind of encourages people to create pilot projects in excess of what would be ideal. I think there are more times that we need something that kind of works to just be done in an ongoing way. We don't need to have experiments all the time. But I think what I see as the answer to that is thinking about some of these objectives and the social networks with a kind of time limit or cycles. In my profession, we talk about strategic planning cycles sometimes, and there are people that really do 7-year planning cycles, and then there are people that prefer 5. I haven't been doing that work professionally as much, but I had really been coming around to the same number I hear in gardening a lot, which is 3 years. And I've been kind of wondering if, and this still ends up creating good pilot projects. If we want to use the Kushaw program as a pilot, there's no reason not to call it that. But I also wonder if we can say, like, look, knowing the human effort involved and what our vision is for seeing this crop shared, like, can we design it so that at the end of 3 years, it'll be graceful for someone else to pick up leadership or for it to end. And I think in a lot of my work, there is a, and the more I talk about this, the more I think it's true. There's like a real tendency to not want to talk about a project like it might end once you do the things you're talking about doing right then. And I look forward to exploring this a little bit more and talking to some other people. But I think it's we can look at we can compare this where we can compare things to open source software too. I mean, there's a lot of open source software that gets worked on for a few years and maybe it's used for a little bit, and then the maintainer or the coding team leaves, and after a while, the software no longer compiles correctly in Linux, or it's got a bug that's not been patched. And that is normal in open source software and agriculture projects. But I think it's not that I'm ashamed, but somehow I do feel a little bit more like I'm supposed to, like anything in agriculture is supposed to just go on and continue to enrich people. And I'm really interested in some of your thoughts and kind of coming to this question of if people also can, people who are participating as volunteers or community growers in a seed project, how can I make sure that I design the materials and the protocols for participating so that they have a chance to learn the key things about what I'm doing? I, as an artist, I'm part of a group called Alternate Roots, and I'm known a bit for one of our principles. I'm an advocate for one called that I call the aesthetics of transparent processes. And what that really means is, especially as an artist, is that I work with community groups to create artistic work too. And there are all kinds of ways of collaborating with groups, gathering stories, all the way up to having people making editorial decisions for what I'm doing. But when I'm doing my best work as a leading a community arts project, I'm really, I think, making it so that there's no like implicit power difference in me as a coordinator, and that there, I'm looking to avoid things like being considered an expert about genetics. I'm hoping that maybe over a cycle of 3 years for a Kushaw project, that people who care enough or want to know about genetics will feel like they've got everything I've got or whatnot. So I've been really thinking about this, and going to seed has probably been around for 2 or 3 years, and I've been participating in it for maybe 2 years. And I wonder too, energetically, if having been a part of like a really exciting organization that's making change, that it is like, it's like it probably are, maybe it's a natural moment for me in that work to just be like, well, look, am I going to do everything I'm doing now forever, or should I start thinking about my legacy or
Well,
whatever?
succession, like it's passing on that package of skills and genetic resources that have to go together. The seed on its own isn't enough. You have to know enough about the crop to handle it well and to be able to pass it on to the next person.
I think it's the concept of like a biological succession has been one of the powerful ideas that I, until I became more serious about studying farming a few years ago, that's not one that I'd really paid a lot of attention to. But I wonder, I think in thinking of human systems, it might have some use in thinking just like what's the natural succession with a project. In the US, we've had this seed train being shipped from one person to the next around the country for the last year or so, and people can add and pull out seeds that they're interested in. And two different seed trains have gone missing in the last 6 months in the United States. And that happens. I don't have a big point to share about that, but it's like two different times. It's like, oh my, we lost the seed bank. I mean, that's not true because it's everywhere. But there's a
Well, it's an example of a fragile structure that you only need one break in that one chain, and then everything downstream is gone. And finding ways of building networked structures that can have that redundancy that allow failure without losing everything, I think that's a really important consideration. I did want to ask you one other question, because you have done a lot of work with local theatre and local music. and building that side of the community as well. Do you think there's any potential synergy between local culture and local agriculture?
There really is, and I wonder how I could share some of the really important moments that I've been a part of that have connected those things. I think there's a sort of technical or tactical answer that I can share as an artist that works a lot in community. When I'm especially working with a group of people for the first time, and perhaps our mission is to create something new together, but we haven't worked together before creatively. I have some exercises that have been passed down to me that get people thinking about their experiences with food and eating. And that, just on a really tactical level, if I'm trying to help a group of people come together and maybe be creative and lower their barriers and joke around with each other, if we can spend an hour and a half or 2 hours as a group talking in this structured way in a story circle or another similar method, like that almost it's like one of the best ways to get a new creative group going. And so that one's I have a few story prompts around food that are like come to mind instantly when I start thinking about community arts. And on another level, I have really been fortunate to have participated in several projects where, for example, gardeners and farmers are contributing their stories and also photography of their gardens as part of a schedule so that we're able to evoke the cycles of their land and kind of their feelings about it. And it's kind of you may have to take my word for this, but to walk into the center of a kind of we have a circular sort of gallery space we converted, and to be kind of in a circular space surrounded by enlarged photographs with just sometimes two or three sentence captions describing not necessarily just what's there, but like what is the farmer's relationship to what we're looking at, which these are all subjects that are familiar, wheelbarrows, plants, cats. But I feel like that's a project that helped bring some of the work you do on your own into a social context. I have been familiar in the past with a food pantry in Tennessee that very literally created a musical play about hunger, which they performed in their facility as part of a project to help some of their own volunteers and organization be able to relate a little bit better about what it's like to come to a food pantry, be in need of food. And so I just feel that the universality of food and often the ways that it relates to our early memories or our culture is a really powerful touchstone for creative work. And it's one of those things that connects people as human beings. And
Do you think locally adapted crops have the potential to become like a cornerstone of local identity? Like this is one of the things that we eat, that we're known for and that we understand.
I know that it's true because there are a few things like that that have survived into our culture here in Eastern Kentucky. And they're for example, the half runner green bean. If you're a commercial grower in Eastern Kentucky, one of the things you're in the club because you can complain about the half runner bean. And it's like the customers only want the half runner bean because it's the legendary. It's the truth, as you probably could guess, is that it's an example of a bean of which there are several types that are easier to grow at different times of the year. But yeah, I've really to an extreme sometimes, but I think there's a couple of things like that here, and I like how you've completely fundamentally made it part of like your low input as part of that question, because I think there isn't I not to I hang around a lot with farmers, and no one really brags about low input success. I mean, I don't want to brag, has got a negative connotation, but you don't often, I'm not seeing conference sessions at the Eastern Kentucky Farmer Conference about low input success, but I feel like that is such an opportunity. We live, again, it's a temperate rainforest that's in a kind of post-extractive economy, and that can lead to some things that are a little different from other, like farmland. For example, there's no compost available to purchase around here. We get together groups of people and buy a bunch and have it trucked in from central Kentucky. And there, unless you can either chip your own wood, in which case maybe like me, I could theoretically have infinite wood chips, or there, but there's no like wood chip delivery like in some urban areas. So
And
we
access to that
want.
technology isn't automatic depending on isolation or finances.
Yeah, and I think, and earlier I tried to start my manifesto about how this should all be fun, and I know that there are people who really enjoy building up their soil and sometimes trucking things in, and that is kind of impressive. I have friends that do that, and I am not here to critique it in any way, but given the economy here, a lot of people that might be interested in starting a garden, especially, it's hard enough to get the resources you need and information. Trucking in compost from afar, or driving down to Virginia and buying a bunch of bagged compost, doesn't sound fun to me. And I think a lot of people, that's where it starts. I'm imagining, and with some experience suggesting this, that more tomatoes that will come up on their own, maybe even if you don't want them, and kushaws that we know we can plant on just a couple of inches of soil, poor soil, like to give people a chance to have some enjoyment. I'd like in my, material for this kushaw project to start recommending some regional ideas for building soil, like finding leaf litter and stuff in forested areas and bringing it in. But I feel like there's too many things that aren't fun that are like little roadblocks for people starting. And I think if someone is getting my seeds, I don't want to have to give them like a bunch of supplies, or be like, well, you might need to put lime out to raise your soil pH. I think if someone's starting with me, I want to give them the wild turnips and the perennial wild okra and all of these squash that make smaller fruits. And I want to be able to say, like, look, if you follow through with this, some of this will fail, but you'll have something to look at this year, and you don't have to build a raised bed. I have f physical disabilities, and some things are just arbitrarily kind of easier or harder for me. And there's just so many resources that are like, oh, you're going to start a small garden, consider building a raised bed. And I want that to be, on the list, but I want people to be able to see first up, like, here is the $20 garden. I can't make it free for you, but it will cost $20, and so on and so forth.
Well, I mean, the first farmers that came west of the United States, they had little more than a hoe and a bag of seeds, and they had to make it work. And it's possible. It's possible.
When I think a lot about agriculture without metal tools, which was how it was, and you're talking about the transitional period when the first hoes may have come around, but I do ponder, we have no reason to think people were especially hungry here hundreds of years ago, but if they wanted to take down a tree, they could girdle it and wait a couple of years, or burn it, and or maybe a flood would come through. And I think that's worth, I think that's the kind of, okay, I'm going to say one more thing, but also those people knew the area, I bet. And some riverbanks were probably, you would know either it was historically fertile, or maybe the flood washed some good looking soil down there. So it's not I don't think people were randomly planting wherever they could. There was an art to it, but I think, yeah, to me,
Is that a
I
hidden
think this.
advantage living in an area that's being depopulated, that there's lots of abandoned space and some of it is good quality soil that's just sitting there covered in weeds?
It is for me an advantage. I sort of like some chores are harder for me physically. Sometimes it is a little easier for me to feel like I'm spending my time productively to adopt a wild population. And so I really, so a couple of f 2 or 3 years ago, that's all I would say I was doing. I could produce a map for you and be like, here's where this is growing. And I visit it every couple months. I'm waiting for it to set seed. This year I did with this dang squash project, I did for the first time very like kind of deliberately plant in plant seeds that I brought to one of those areas where I'd been harvesting some other plants. And I think I've got a busy schedule. I don't have a ton of time to guerrilla garden. And if I did, I would be very respectful, but I like about putting plants in places. But I do admire, there are some folks that I see on social media that will, especially perennials or and native plants or fruit trees. I really believe that in a little better version of our society here, that it would be like a lot of these waste areas would have more plants in them and people would be coming and going, and they would, while they weren't being used for something else, it would be kind of a given thing that foragers would be welcome. And my utopian vision for the future really does, like we have this post-industrial type space, but then we also have things that a lot of areas do, like high tension power lines. And we have some passing through the farm here. And I wish, 1% of those power line right of ways that were close to roads were planted with things you could go get cuttings from or save seeds from that were useful in your area. And we'll see where my work takes me, but that is very much in the spirit of the Renew Appalachia strip mine site that I've been describing. Is, can we, yeah, could we not actually proactively make orchards once in a while in the median of a highway?
Yeah.
Right now, I don't know. So if you'd like to work with me on that, and especially if anyone wants to move here to the farm and full-time plant on power line right of ways, I think that as a farmer, my contributions are not likely to be supplying a substantial amount of produce to my community here. But I'm very interested in being able to, if someone's looking for something that will grow well for them, or they may have an area that they would like to see feel more friendly, and they would like some positive plant energy, I'd like to be able to in some ways kind of help fill in the blank spot where they might have been able to walk down the road and ask those questions. I'd like to be able to point people to some stuff. And partly it is because I've had the time and inspiration to do trials and do the land race approach. And not everybody's gonna need to do that or want to. I think our what for me, after the next 3 year cycle of Kushaw work, will be like, are we, when we have a new reality where for at least a few crops here locally that I'm working with people on, and we do have a half dozen or 10 farms that are kind of saving their own seeds, maybe 50 people tried growing Kushaws and 10 had a good time and save seeds. That those are numbers that I think are probably plausible for my project. And so 3 years from now, we only have 10 more farms and gardens, but they all have their house variety of Kushaws. I think that's when we start looking, being able once again to kind of look at questions you're raising, like, should we give away our regional fruit? Or for Kushaws, I do have an angle where it's one of the only like kind of diverse species that is sold commercially. So I want to keep people selling it and not just giving this away. But I really do see a path forward with my project. And I think I'm sure other people that are trying to do seed projects where we'll have growers with it. And that's, yeah, I I look forward to the, I think the 3-year cycle is going to get, next time you see the Google documents about my Kushaw project at the end of the year, they'll all be referring to how we've completed the first season in our 3-year cycle. And I think the remaining work on that for me is where I've just been saying here now, like, what's the vision that I want to create in 3 years, for
Three is a
that,
really
like,
good magical number for storytelling and for psychology. The beginning, middle, and end. It makes things feel achievable.
yeah. And I feel like somehow with, if you're in, seed increase, it gives you a year to not be immediately successful. I think that's maybe for me one of the magical ingredients for these, for learning some of these methodologies, is really the kind of, you have to trust maybe in the system a little bit, but the idea that you might have a year or two with low yields, but if you're really attentive, that's part of a process. That's not, I think it's kind of just the way it's natural to talk about gardening, maybe, but it can be easy to just talk about things one season at a time. And like, I did not have a good year last year for squash, but with a adaptive gardening and a kind of maybe a 3-year approach, you can start to talk about that in terms of selection. And that's where I think this is going to be successful, is being able to reframe that.
Who do you think I should talk to next? Do you have any kind of dream guests that you'd love to see on the podcast?
Oh, wow. One area that I've mentioned earlier that I'm really intellectually curious about is wide crossing. This is the kind of thing I read sort of for pleasure, knowing that I'm a year or two away from like mentor grafting, but I'm quite, I said this earlier, I think people are not, I just, there's a lot of stuff no one's been trying, or no one knows about whether it would work. And but I'm aware that there are like just folks out there day to day that are already making wide crosses. They may not have any next step for them yet, but I just, yes, any resources that kind of help bring that to life for me. I've somehow, maybe in Joseph Lofthouse's material, or I've absorbed this idea of growing, wild crop relatives near your garden. And I don't work in energetic ways predominantly, but there is something about putting those wild relatives next to your garden and having a lot of intention about letting them cross. And I can tell there's potential for really awesome things to happen. And I'm guessing that maybe the missing piece is just some of those methodologies. So yeah, wide crosses. Yeah, Google Scholar searching for intraspecific and Cucurbita, or same thing with Molothria intergeneric. Yeah, that's really where my blue sky thinking is. Just
I'll
like,
try and track down more people on those topics because it's one that I think is so fascinating. I almost see characters like Luther Burbank as a kind of a foreshock of, like, why was there only one Luther Burbank? Why can't there be thousands of them? He didn't have to do a fancy degree. He didn't have, an expensive laboratory. He just got out in the garden and tried things and followed his curiosity.
Yeah, I think, and for me, I believe the person whose work I found before Joseph Lofthouse was Kelly Winterton. I'm not sure if you're familiar with his potato onion research. He's published about it extensively, so you could look up his grow logs. You can actually, he's it's very idiosyncratic, but you can see years of his records online. But he sort of discovered that these varieties of onion that had never been seen flowering could be induced to flower. And when they did, the offspring, his latest theory was that it freed the offspring from the viral load that had been accumulating in those bulbs over decades or hundreds of years. And that's like a it opened up. And so not only were they offspring more vigorous, but then you could also theoretically cross them. So there's new hybrids. So, and that kind of, there are, I think, these little windows, and one person can cover a species, especially if they've got a few years like that. And it's a real, here in Eastern Kentucky, as a member of the Community Farm Alliance, there's been a real theme of citizen science and peer learning, because, and
And
I,
the
yeah.
internet has made that possible. Like, while we've got the internet, like in the 90s, this would have been very difficult to do. Just finding the people and finding the inspiration almost was impossible. Like, unless you happened to live right next door to somebody who was doing this work, you'd never even realize it was possible. And we may not have the internet forever. Like, in how many generations from now, it may not be something that is still cheap and accessible.
That's true. And I feel one of the things that I've been trying to share with my local contacts is the value of these communication tools. Like, and I use the going to seed as an example. But I get, I it's, as far as I can tell, it's purely about whether something was founded mainly on the internet and more recently versus an older associations. But I've really been trying to convince some of the local groups to start using forums or Discord, just to be able to have, or even Facebook groups actually too. And some folks are, but I really, when I'm working with a group of people that has always worked on the internet, it's very obvious that we're kind of being held back here. And maybe this is a remote thing. Maybe if you're in a place where the farms are easier to get to, and they don't, you don't have to worry as much. But I really feel like for Appalachia, the some of the communications resources might be just as useful as the more like agricultural ones.
So if people want to learn any more about your work, where can they look? How can they get in touch? I'll drop any links in the show notes.
There is a Facebook group, Commonwealth Kushaw is the term. We are the state of Kentucky, as opposed to some of the other states in the US, is a commonwealth, which is a mostly philosophical but kind of important distinction. We don't call ourselves a state here. We are Kentucky belongs to the people who live in it, according to our tradition. So that thus the name Commonwealth Kushaw. I realize that that may have other meanings, but the Facebook group and the Going to Seed forum are the two places to interact with me or the project. And
Excellent.
depending on where you're located, maybe to request seeds. We'd love to talk to you if you're in the US and want to grow Kushaws.
Excellent. So, what is your final message for people thinking about getting into local agriculture?
I think that you should give it a try. And I have felt at times a little like I'm marching to a different drum. And there have been times when I really wondered if digging up soil from all the different areas where I could find variations and planting things into them and posting about that on the Going to Seed forum, I wondered if that was actually going to bear fruit for me, because the first couple of years of these adaptation projects can be brutal. And yeah, I've had piles of all different soil and tiny scraggly plants, and I'm, 2 years later, I have some really amazing plants, some that I found, some that I've crossed and grew, and others that I got from neighbors that I didn't even know when I started. And it's really something that you can't do in 1 year, but I think you should give it a try and pace yourself.
That's a wonderful parting message. So, Mark, thank you very much for taking the time to chat with me and the audience. And hopefully I'll get to catch up again in a few years' time and see how things are going.
Awesome, and good luck with your projects. Thank you, Shane.
The Zero Input Agriculture Podcast is a solo passion project built with my ample time and meager resources. If you would like to support the show, then sign up for a paid subscription to my Zero Input Agriculture blog at Substack. As a reward, you can read all my past posts and listen to the audiobook of Taming the Apocalypse. If you prefer reading about the past and future of biological technology, you can read the ebook of Taming the Apocalypse through Amazon. And finally, please rate and review the show on whatever podcast app you use, since it helps other people find me, or recommend the show directly to anyone who could use some inspiration to become a plant breeder themselves.